Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Real fast, before we get underway, we are heading toward the big event, the 300th broadcast, November 19th, at the DoubleTree by Hilton, Dallas Richardson. Big live event. Matt Dillahunty's doing a 45-minute magic show, and Shelley Siegel's doing a live concert. Speakers include Aaron Raw and David Smalley and Sarah Hader. A two-hour event, a broadcast. Our 300th show incorporates all the speakers and the live audience, a meet and greet afterwards, and essentially a chance to hang out with the speakers all day. It's going to be amazing. Those $15 tickets, we had 200 of them to sell out, and we sold out almost immediately. So our sponsor, Fellowship of Freethought Dallas, called the DoubleTree and said, look, we'd like to try to expand, and they've invested in that expansion to the tune of an extra 120 tickets. Those seats are going fast. If you want to be there on Saturday, November 19th, get your tickets right now. Go to fofdallas.org/300live, and I will see you there for the big event, November the 19th. Today's broadcast is a little bit unusual, but I think it's going to be really enjoyable for you, especially if you are a fan of audiobooks. I, my friends, have narrated an audiobook for the first time, a book that I have not written myself. Now, I've narrated my own stuff in the past. This is the first audiobook I've ever done that was written by somebody else. And very quickly, I'll kind of tell you how it happened and why. In just a few, after I interview the author, I'm going to play for you the first 5 chapters, full chapters, of that audiobook. I receive so much information doing what I do. So many people are sending me worthy projects, you know, books or blogs or videos or documentaries or what have you. And as a single host and activist, it's just impossible to keep up with even a large fraction of what I'm sent. It's just physically not possible to do it all. It's such a huge time commitment already to be a producer and a host and to travel and to do the things that I do that I just don't have all the time I would like to have for projects that come down the pipe. Well, a book was sent to me by an author named Lee Bervine. Never heard of him. The book was called The Kefir Project. What got my attention was that Dr. Lawrence Krauss, the theoretical physicist, had written the foreword for it. Now you had my attention. And so I opened The Kefir Project and I read it and I was just blown away. The book is a thriller. It's a sci-fi novel. But it's not set in outer space. It's set here on planet Earth. And it is using fiction to say some very important and I think very courageous things about religion, specifically the Abrahamic religions, but all religion out there, period. It's really a challenge to superstitious thinking. And I thought the approach was so well done that I agreed to be the narrator for the audiobook, which is just now releasing. And I'll just play my cards up front. I'm presenting this to you not just because I want you to have something fun to listen to and not just because I'm hoping that you may enjoy what you hear and will further take the journey with the audiobook or even the paper version. There's an ebook out and some other options. I really do think the project itself has merit. I mean, I wouldn't have been a part of it if I thought otherwise. And for those who enjoy my vocal style, I thought perhaps they would enjoy The Kefir Project. So I'm going to talk to the author, Lee Bervine, for about 20-25 minutes, and you just have the option. You can listen to the setup, which I think is compelling. I think Lee's got a lot of amazing things to say, and I think hearing him color how the book came about, what he wants it to accomplish, the environments that this book is being released into, and the consequences to those cultures. I think all of that has merit and is definitely worth listening to. But the truth is if you didn't want to listen to the opening setup with the author, you can just skip right past it and just jump right into the book and listen to the first five chapters of The Kefir Project. And you've got the choice. Lawrence Krauss has called this a thrilling roller coaster ride, fast-paced and riveting. I couldn't put it down. Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation said Berveen gives the world a new kind of hero, an intelligent science communicator in the mold of a Richard Dawkins or Neil deGrasse Tyson. Dr. Peter Boghossian called it a compelling read that weds scientific accuracy with an anti-scriptural plot. Natalia Reagan from the National Geographic Channel says it grips you from the first page, seamlessly intertwined sci-fi, applied physics, and a healthy dose of archaeology. And the accolades go on and on and on. So let me start with the author and bring on to the broadcast right now, Lee Berveen. Hey, Lee, it's great to have you, man.
Thank you for having me here. Very excited.
Let's start with the guy who wrote the foreword for your book, Lawrence Krauss. How did you get him involved?
I flew out to a skeptics conference at Caltech, one of those wonderful conferences that Michael Shermer sponsors. And Lawrence was a featured speaker there. And I saw him during one of the breaks walking towards the signing table. He was going to sign autographs. And my heart was in my mouth because I'm something of a social phobic. I'm not exactly a people guy. And in my mind, I'm about to approach somebody that I really admire, really respect. And I'm going to ask him to give 8 hours or more of his time to nobody, somebody he's never met. And then I'm going to ask him to put his reputation on the line, so to speak, to endorse this thing.
Well, yeah, and he's pitched by everybody everywhere he goes. Everybody's got a project or a point of view or, something that they want him to stamp his name on. So that's an even tougher nut to crack, right?
Yeah, that was a steep hill to climb, and I knew that I was facing that. And I walked up to him and I said, hi, I'm your worst nightmare. I'm a fan who's written a book. And he didn't run, which was great. He didn't want to accept a physical copy of the book because he was traveling. So he gave me an email and then began the saga of me stalking Lawrence Krauss while trying not to appear to be stalking Lawrence Krauss. He's an amazingly busy, busy guy. Yeah. And he was just finishing up a book. And I sent him the ebook. A couple of weeks later, I mailed him a hard copy. About a month or two later, I emailed him and he was kind enough to respond that he's still interested but didn't have time. And I think it was a good 4 months or so before he'd finished up his book obligations and actually read. And then he got hooked. It was wonderful. He got hooked. He read the opening of the book on a plane flight. And then, as he said, he literally couldn't put it down, which is a problem because he still had a lot of other things to do.
That's pretty amazing. It's hard to nail somebody like Krauss down. And I love Lawrence Krauss. I love his style. I think he's a tremendous science educator and activist and a great promoter of rationalism out there. But you don't waste Lawrence Krauss's time. He'll just tell you.
No,
you're wasting my time. You know, I'm a busy man. I got things to do. And so if you can get the guy to lock down on the book, it's pretty impressive. So.
Right. And the book is a mystery thriller, but it is also essentially science fiction. And Krauss has, as he says, a kind of love-hate relationship with science fiction, because ever since he wrote The Physics of Star Trek, he's been asked to comment on every science fiction book that's been published. So the fact that he was willing to overlook that and take the time. And then he wrote I didn't have any hopes that he would do what he did. And he wrote the foreword. I was hoping to get a blurb from him. That he sat down and wrote a foreword just absolutely blew my mind. And he was very kind. And he said some delightful things about the book. And now we correspond from time to time. And I get to, whether it's justified or not, I get to tell people about my friend Lawrence Krauss, which is really fun.
Drop his name as parties.
Hey. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I was talking to Lawrence Krauss the other day.
I call him Larry.
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the book is a piece of fiction, but there's an agenda behind it. This book wants to accomplish something besides just entertaining the readers. That something is one of the reasons that we're talking on this broadcast. You want to talk about your quote-unquote agenda for the Kefir Project?
Yeah. You know, I don't hide it. There is an agenda. It's a didactic book, and that's considered a bad word in fiction. But it's some of my favorite novels are didactic novels. To Kill a Mockingbird, Grapes of Wrath, which everyone had to read in high school, and whether you agree with her or not, all of Ayn Rand's novels are didactic, and she achieved a lot.
Now, by didactic, you mean that the book itself is presenting a story, but it's arguing for a specific position. It's trying to sell a certain point of view, right?
Sure. And to make it interesting, I do try to present more than one side of the argument, but there's a side of the argument that I'm clearly championing. And my agenda is to do what Dan Brown, the author of Da Vinci Code, did, but to do it with information that's a little bit more academic, a little bit more, well, it's scientific, it's peer-reviewed. Somebody wrote a really nice review of the book, and one of the things they mentioned was they couldn't remember the last time they read a novel that had 17 scientific citations in a bibliography at the end of the book, everything from quantum computing to biblical archaeology. So, yeah, there was a lot of hard research that went into the book. It's something of a Trojan horse. You know, after Brown published his novel, he had about 80 million readers, and I don't know how many people saw the movie. So that's an awful lot of people who, yeah, they were talking about the Priory of Sion, which turned out to be somebody's elaborate hoax. But they were also talking about the Council of Nicaea. And they were also talking about the idea that Jesus did not necessarily consider himself to be divine. In fact, it's debatable whether the man himself, if he existed, I'm of the opinion that there probably was an historical figure behind the myths, but the man himself may not have even considered himself the Messiah. It's debatable. But people were talking about that. And a lot of people were talking about that. And so, yeah, I would like people to be talking about ideas like there was almost certainly no Exodus. There's absolutely no archaeological support to the notion that the Jewish people suddenly appeared in Canaan. And it's actually more likely that they were a particular Canaanite tribe. Not only did they not come back in conquest, they really never left. And there's ideas like you'll learn about the Hyksos people, who were a Jewish people who were in Egypt for a time, but they were rulers. They were rulers of the Nile Valley for a brief time, and then they were actually booted out. But it appears that their story was adopted and adapted. So, you know, for people to be talking about that, for people to be talking about the possibility that the Quran is in part, we all know it's derivative, but there's strong evidence that it was in part plagiarized from a Syro-Aramaic Christian document, word for word, that it was portions of it, large portions of the Quran, it appears, weren't even written in Arabic. And that's something that people could talk about. They could talk about the fact that almost certainly there was no tomb. There was no tomb. The one piece of powerful physical evidence that could be pointed to say, well, these weren't just apparitions. These people weren't seeing ghosts or imagining things because there's this piece of physical evidence. There's a tomb and there's a body that's gone. Well, no, there was no tomb. And there's a lot of good reasons to conjecture that that was the case, including the fact that the man who was supposed to have taken Jesus' body, Joseph of Arimathea, came from a town that didn't exist. Not only was there no Arimathea, but the name itself is a kind of pun. It's a pun on Aristos Matthias, meaning best disciple. And even the ea suffix is the Greek equivalent of something like vil or burg. So you have a man called who was the best disciple, the only one who didn't run, who happened to come from a town called Best Discipleburg or Best Discipleville. These are the kind of things that are woven into the story.
Yeah, you've totally threaded some of the, you've obviously got the Abrahamic religions in your crosshairs with the Kefir Project.
Yeah, and that was really where the whole thing started from. It began with this fantasy. I was thinking about Scientology and, to a lesser extent, the Mormon religion, and how we can actually look into their origins. You know, we can check what Scientology says about its dear leader, and we can see that, well, he wasn't actually a war hero. And we can look at court transcripts in which Joseph Smith pleads guilty to being a fraud and to duping people out of money, saying that he could help them find treasure with these magic stones. I mean, those are actually physical documents that you can look at photos of them online today if you wanted to. And so the thought was, what if the origins of the Abrahamic religions weren't shrouded in the mists of history? What if you could actually see that? Like taking somebody by the hand and walking them through the seams and seeing that they don't match up with the stories. What would happen? What would people do? What kind of conflicts would arise? And so I just had to come up with a plausible scenario where that might happen. And that's the nut of the story.
You have a scientist as your protagonist. Is Gavin Reese based on a specific scientist, or is he an amalgam of several?
The latter. He is an amalgam. And he came about because of something that Orson Scott Card wrote, that if you're trying to write a story and you've come up with just the concept, which is where I started, and you have to populate the story, then you ask yourself, who would suffer the most? And since this was going to be a thriller, I thought it would be really fun to put in somebody who had no fighting skills, who wasn't particularly brave, who had no military or police experience at all. And the idea of a science popularizer jumped into my head. And when you think of a science popularizer, probably most of us first think of Carl Sagan or now Neil deGrasse Tyson. But, and this is going to sound like I'm currying favor again, my favorite science popularizer was Lawrence Krauss.
When we say that the book has religious subtext to it, well, not just subtext, religious text, it deals overtly and in a subversive way with religion. Yeah. But it's really a ride. You know, it's a mystery. There's clue finding. There's car chases. There's foot chases. You know, there's the dark figure pointing the gun. And you've got all these almost Hollywood-esque type things in the book, which was a surprise for me. I was expecting something pretty dry.
Sure. You know, and you're not the first to say that. When people come at the book with the understanding that, okay, this is, he's got an agenda and he's going to try to prove things. And geez, look, he's got all of this academic research that he's going to try to work in there. They don't expect that they're picking up a page turner. But that's what I knew I had to achieve. That if the book wasn't literally nearly impossible to put down for the reader, that I would have considered it a failure.
And Michael Crichton, in my opinion, ran into some of this, a brilliant writer, mm-hmm. but he would also, in many of his later books especially, would get lost in the exposition. He was so busy trying to ground his fictional works in quote-unquote science, some of it good science, some of it bad science, but science, that he would derail the story itself. He would just spend page upon page upon page upon page explaining the science, trying to root it in reality, and he killed his own momentum. And I was impressed that you managed to avoid that pitfall with the Kefir Project. And I'm not just kissing your ass. I mean, you really do maintain a flow and momentum in the project.
Well, first, feel free to kiss my ass. And, and second, thank you. Yeah, I didn't want to pull a Herman Melville. I didn't want to have entire chapters about the shapes and sizes and configurations of harpoons just because there was whaling in it. So I borrowed and copied and stole every bit of technique I could find from the great thriller writers, from James Patterson and even a Lee Child. Although I don't have Lee Child's prose style. He writes like Hemingway with ADHD. And I'm not quite that choppy, but the chapters are very brief. Some chapters are one page, no chapters more than 6 or 7 pages long. And each chapter has a little story arc. And at the end of each chapter, you're either left hanging or something huge has happened. There are tricks of the trade, and I applied them. And it seems to be working. My favorite comment from any reader thus far was, "You bastard, I had to take a day off from work to finish this."
As a first-time novelist, though, are you having that conversation? I don't deserve this. I'm a pretender.
I have feelings like that in this respect. When somebody buys a novel, they're buying a ticket to a show, and this is a 90,000-word novel, so this is 8 to 10 hours of reading. So they're coming to sit down and listen to you, and it's just you and them. So it's like being in a theater with one person sitting in a seat. And they're going to listen to you go on for 8 hours. And you're telling them at the get-go, "Oh, yeah. No, this is absolutely worth it. Oh, no, take my word for this," because they don't know you. They don't know your work, and nobody's seen you yet. Like you said, a first-time novelist. You're striking a bargain with somebody and making a promise. And it's an enormous promise. And it really feels like a promise that I can't keep that promise. Some of this is got to be boring to you, but that's what you fight against. You fight against the idea that who was the writer? Elmore Leonard, when asked about why his writing flows so well and why people love his book so much, he said, "I don't write the parts that people skip."
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And what a great line.
Yeah. And if you're writing a thriller, then you just have to do that. You know, the biggest challenge in my mind, the most scary thing was characters. Because in sci-fi, as much as I love sci-fi, there is a lot of sci-fi out there where it's just sententious talking heads. And every character sounds like every other character, and dialogue's being put in their mouth that's really scientific exposition. And how do you grab people's hearts? How do you create people that the readers are going to fall in love with?
The audiobook is about 10 hours, or at least it was coming out of my studio.
It's about the same.
It's the first audiobook I've ever read that wasn't something I myself had written. It was really different in that way.
Yeah, and that was wonderful of you. I mean, talk about somebody taking a leap of faith. For you to jump in to this project was... it was a real shot in the arm in a lot of ways.
And well, I want to get in front of that, too. There are a lot of people, there are probably some people in the audience who may be predisposed to cynicism, if not just skepticism. And they're like, "Come on, he read the book. He's wanting to sell books. Lee's his guest because they've collaborated. This is one long infomercial." And the truth of it is that I'm pitched a ton of stuff. And while much of it has merit, it's not a good fit for me. It doesn't really fit into what I do as an activist, as a broadcaster, as a producer.
Yeah.
There are very few things that come my way where I stop everything and think, "Holy shit, this is really something exceptional." And the Kefir Project for me being one of those things where I didn't just say, "This was really well done," but I actually would like the opportunity to read the audiobook. I think it would be great fun. I also liked its boldness. And this is a gutsy book. It goes right after in a very sharp way. Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and far beyond. The challenging of Islam here in not just the 21st century, but any century. You know, it brings to light many questions. It's certainly something that Islam, in many respects, is not used to. You know, the fact that it is criticized, whether it's by news commentators or whether it's by scientists or whether it's by novelists. And yet you have taken on the challenge of the Abrahamic religions, including Islam, in the Kefir Project.
Yeah, and I've done that because I think that there is a principle that has generated more misery in human history than any other alone. And that is the principle that the truth can be known or established by authority. And it's antithetical to science. It's antithetical to free thought. And it is exactly what allows people to rule over other people by use of force, to take their freedoms, to say what they can do, who they can marry, what they can read, what they can say. Why? Why can't I do all of that? Well, because the truth is that those things are bad. Well, how do I know that's true? Well, it is written in these books. That's how we know. Even on that level, something like Russian or Chinese communism becomes a kind of religion. Even though there's not an actual God, there is still a figure of authority, whether it's a man or it's a prophet or it's a book, it's always the same principle. And we cannot know what's true and what's right apart from experiment and evidence. So all of these horrors in my mind are made possible by this one idea that these books are holy, these books have the revealed truth, and I just want to knock the pins out from under that. The Enlightenment, you and I can agree, was a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's why we get to talk about what we talk about. And the Enlightenment really began with biblical criticism. There was a day when, of course, you couldn't say anything about the Bible. There was a day when you couldn't get your hands on a Bible. There was a day where if you didn't have an education and couldn't read Latin, you had no idea what it said, even if you got your hands on it. And that was just the way some people liked it. But then the Bible became available, and it was translated into the common vernacular. And much later, people began to say, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And wait a minute, that there are contradictions here. And that's where our freedom began. And to its great shame, and in a perverse way to its credit, Islam has managed to stave that off. Here we are in the 21st century, and it's still, you know, the 16th century there. You can't say anything. You can't. Nobody, apart from a handful of academics, many of whom are writing under pseudonyms, have undertaken a serious historical examination of the Quran. And why not? I mean, how many billion people follow this book as their guide to life? We shouldn't examine it. We shouldn't look at it. So, yeah, I'm taking them to task over that.
Are you putting the word blasphemer on your business card, you know? Lee Berbeen, blasphemer. Put it on a resume, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to be a hyphenate. I'm going to be a writer hyphen blasphemer hyphen associate producer.
Now, you have graciously given me permission to share. We're going to do several chapters from the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And we're going to actually read chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5. They are shorter chapters, but to just, rather than say, well, trust me, folks, it'll be great, I want to go ahead and sort of give them the morsel in the hopes that if they enjoy what they hear, they'll come back for the rest of the book. But how many chapters are in the book itself, roughly?
There are approximately 66 chapters in the book, if you don't include Professor Krauss's foreword. But like you said, they're short chapters,
And you're totally cool with me just throwing the first 5 chapters out there on the radio for the audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Give it to them. And
all right.
And I thank you for the opportunity to do that.
We also need to say an acknowledgement to Emery, who was a producer behind the scenes. I mean, I just did raw vocals, and then Emery sort of went in, and I guess he did some massaging and tightening up of some audio. Is that right?
Or? He used his comic instincts to work his magic on the audio. He's a wonderful guy. People will know him from his work with Penn Jillette, and he edited the hysterical documentary, The Aristocrats. And he's been a terrific guy to work with.
Before I read these chapters to sort of cap the broadcast, where can people find you? Where can they find the Kafir Project? What formats is it in? Give me the whole spiel here.
Okay. Kafirproject.com.
Spell it for me.
K-A-F-I-R Project. Kafirproject.com is the home page. And if you're on Facebook, you can look up the Kafir Project on Facebook. It also has a page and a lot of fun stuff there. And the book is available on Amazon in the Kindle format. It's also available there as a paperback. The audiobook is now available on audible.com. And I also want to make a special offer to your listeners. And I'd be grateful if they'd spread the word. But I'm going to make for a very brief amount of time the ebook available at kefirproject.com for free. And, well, it's not entirely for free. I'm going to ask you to agree to certain terms and conditions. And one of those terms and conditions is that you sign your soul over to Lee Bravin. But if you're willing to sign your soul over to me, I will allow you to download a free copy of the Kefir Project.
Oh, yeah, the beautiful part of this is that I have religious friends who would not be laughing with the rest of us, those of us who have long rejected the idea of the soul and torment or, you know, the eternal consequences of just such a Faustian bargain.
Yeah.
They're literally horrified. Oh, my God, he's not going to sign the soul over. It's not even funny. It's not even funny to do that.
No, and so there are many of our friends out there will be able to enjoy the book free when many, many millions of people can't. And I think that's kind of delicious.
All right. Well, you really are a blasphemer.
Oh, yeah.
It really does need to go on a business card. Well, that's really cool of you to do that for the ebook and the audiobook. Great fun to read. Thanks for including me in the project. And we'll make sure and get the word out. I'll put links in the description box. And again, we will cap this show with a full 5 chapters from the Kefir Project. It's been a privilege, Lee Bravin. All my best for the project. And kefirproject.com for those that would like to find out more. Much appreciated, sir.
Thank you, Seth. It has been wonderful talking with you today and fantastic working with you. And there's a real treat waiting out there for your fans now.
Okay, here we go with chapters 1-5 of The Kefir Project by Lee Bravin. Hope you enjoy. The Quran on which we sent down to you is the fountainhead of divine knowledge and the chief source of divine information. It elucidates every aspect of every thought, and it is a guide into all truth. Surah An-Nahl, 1689. I'm afraid that the schools will prove the very gates of hell, unless they diligently labor in explaining the holy scriptures and engraving them in the hearts of the youth. Martin Luther. Science is what we have learned about how to keep from fooling ourselves. Richard Feynman. Chapter 1. The face-to-face meeting came as a huge surprise to Gavin Rees. To begin with, Edward Fisher was notoriously reclusive. The world's most celebrated physicist never granted personal interviews to a science communicator like Rees, let alone ask for one. Additionally, he was dead. Or he was supposed to be, anyway. Rees leaned into the salt mist blowing cold off San Francisco Bay and watched as Fisher, looking very much alive in dark sunglasses and a red and gold 49ers hoodie, continued to scour the waterfront. "Are we expecting someone else?" Rees asked. "Our muscle." "Muscle?" "Yes, but we can't wait any longer. Gavin, you're in serious danger. You weren't directly involved in the research, so I wasn't as discreet with your identity as I was with the others. That was a mistake." "Others? Wait, what kind of danger?" "You didn't tell anyone you were coming out here to meet me." "No, I did exactly as you ask." Rees was doing his best to look calm. Given how he really felt, that amounted to lying with his face. "Can you just tell me what's going on here, please? Everyone thinks you died in the explosion at Fermilab. They're saying they found you. Pieces of you."
"I want them to believe they succeeded in killing me. They think they've destroyed all my data, but it's still right here in my DNA. Oddly enough, we owe that one to Church. Herodotus will have it all soon, if not already. 500 exabytes. He'll be contacting you."
"Herodotus?"
"An alias for his protection. Another man we're calling Anaximander is bringing the artifacts, the science I'm entrusting to you." Fisher dug into a beaten-up leather pouch he'd slung over one shoulder and mumbled to himself. "It's all coming together. The end of their authority."
"Artifacts? Jesus, he's lost his mind."
Rees wondered if the shock of the explosion had thrown the man into some kind of psychotic episode. By reputation, he wasn't all that mentally stable to begin with. At 33, Fisher was 10 years younger than Rees. But right now, shaky and slum-shouldered, he actually looked the older of the two men. He began to pull a notebook of some kind out of the pouch, but stopped in mid-motion. He was looking over Reese's right shoulder, eyes tracking something back there. Reese turned and looked too. A middle-aged Japanese couple, tourists judging by the guidebook they were consulting, strolled close by. Apart from them, this stretch of Fisherman's Wharf near Pier 35 was mostly deserted, swept clear by dark skies and the imminent threat of a chilling December rainstorm. Behind the two tourists, a white van pulled up to the curb nearby and stopped. As Reese turned back toward Fisher, the scientist jerked the pouch off his shoulder. "No, they can't have it." He heaved it over a nearby railing into the bay. Then he turned back to Reese. "Run!" Before Reese could even move, he heard a loud pop. Fisher dropped in place, like someone had just flipped off his master power switch. A man in sunglasses and billed cap, wearing a Jimmy Buffett t-shirt, stood outside the van now, maybe 100 feet away. He held a gun in front of him in a two-handed grip. A large black cylinder stuck out from the end of the barrel. Reese tried to run and couldn't. His feet seemed bolted to the ground. The two Japanese tourists didn't have the same problem, apparently. They turned and fled up the waterfront. The gun popped again, once, twice. As Reese watched, the man and woman both dropped. The man lay there quietly. The woman screamed as she tried to crawl away. A third shot silenced her. Reese, meanwhile, had finally come unstuck. Survival instinct kicked in, and the rest was automatic. Without looking back, he took a single long step and launched himself headfirst over the railing. Another pop behind him. Gray sky and green water rotated, trading places while he tumbled. Cold shock as he plunged into the bay, the taste of salt water in his mouth. Reese opened his eyes underwater, fighting the sting after shutting them reflexively. Disoriented, twisting this way and that, he hunted for the surface, having already formed the intention to swim the hell away from it. There, he spotted the green glow of daylight filtering through the murky waters. Above and below suddenly fell into place again in this weightless and featureless expanse. Making his best guess, Reese swam downward and in the direction that he fervently hoped would take him back under the walkway. He couldn't see much further than the tips of his fingers, though. For all he knew, he would be forced to resurface in full view of the gunman. He swam using breaststroke and frog kick, on and on. The green emptiness all around killed any sense of forward progress. His lungs felt about to burst. This had to be too far. If he were going the right way, he'd have reached... Something materialized out of the haze in front of him. A pylon encrusted with barnacles and marine algae. His lungs burned as he let himself float upward alongside it. It looked dark above him, so he was coming up under some kind of structure, thank God. Reese broke the surface, purged his lungs explosively, gulped briny air, then dove right back down. He held his breath as long as he could, and then floated up again for another quick lungful of air. He repeated this process maybe 20 times. Eventually, Reese reasoned that if the man with the gun were coming for him, he would probably have been discovered by now. The next time he came up for air, he stayed on the surface and looked around. He was under the walkway from which he had jumped. No sign of the shooter. After another 5 minutes or so of waiting, he decided to risk a move. The situation merited an abundance of caution, so he planned to swim from pylon to pylon, staying under the walkway wherever possible, and to head for Pier 39. There was a marina over there and people. He could call for help. Reese had just started out when his hand bumped something floating, half submerged in the water. Fisher's leather pouch. He pulled the strap over his shoulder and began to swim. Making good on its threat, the sky finally let loose torrents of frigid rain. The splashes of thousands of heavy drops hissed loudly around him as Reese slogged toward Pier 39 and that marina. The swim seemed to take forever. When they pulled him from the water, his teeth chattered so violently he couldn't make himself understood. Finally, he managed to get out two words: police and murder.
Chapter 2. Sometimes regular people look a lot like famous people, the officer whose name tag identified him, as Honeycutt explained. We have an ID kit that works on exactly that principle. Some guys got Brad Pitt's eyes, John Travolta's chin, or what have you. Within minutes of Reese being hauled out of the bay, Honeycutt and his partner had arrived at the marina in a patrol car, siren wailing and lights flashing. A rescue vehicle followed another minute later, repeating the noisy show. No, it wasn't a look-alike, Reese said. Okay? Edward Fisher asked me to meet him here. I flew out here to meet him. He said someone was trying to kill him. He wanted them to think he was dead, but he isn't. I mean, he may be now, but... It sounded insane even to Reese, and that was without the bit about the ancient Greek code names he'd intentionally left out. Nevertheless, the officers called it in. From what he could make out, a police unit was dispatched to the scene near Pier 35. Honeycutt rode in the back of the ambulance with him for the short trip to San Francisco General. Hospital staff in the ER stripped off Reese's wet clothes and buried him under layers of warm blankets. Shortly after that, Officer Honeycutt took the full report. Lanky and bug-eyed, Honeycutt actually looked a lot like a young Christopher Walken, though Reese certainly wasn't going to mention it. So you got a phone call last night from Edward Fisher, Honeycutt asked. Yes. He called me in New York. This is after he was killed in the explosion? Yes. No. Obviously he hadn't been killed. He wanted me to meet him here in San Francisco. And no, he didn't say why. Just that no one could know. I grabbed the first flight out of LaGuardia this morning. And were you friends? Had you worked together? No, we'd spoken before, just once. I'm a science communicator. Uh-huh. And what is that exactly? Well, you've heard of Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm basically in the same line of business. Honeycutt jabbed a finger at Reese. Oh, yeah, on TV, right? This was good. At least the officer might be less inclined to think he was just some random lunatic. You recognize me now? Honeycutt shook his head. No, sorry, I've seen those other two guys. Oh, anyway, the point is, that's why Fisher wanted to speak with me. There was some science he needed to make clear to the public, to non-scientists, something that he was working on. Right, okay, Honeycutt wrote something in a spiral notepad. In Reese's imagination, the officer was drawing a caricature of him in a straitjacket, running away while men in white suits with giant butterfly nets chased after him. Honeycutt asked for a description of the gunman. Reese couldn't give him much, only that the shooter had been a white male of average height and weight, who might have had blonde hair. He apologized for not being able to offer more. No, that's good. It's a good start, Honeycutt put away his pad and pen, and excused himself to check in with his superior. Reese lay back under the mound of blankets in the busy ER, amid the beeps and pings of medical monitors and the sharp smell of disinfectant. Pins and needles sensations pricked his hands and feet as the restored blood flow woke up the peripheral nerves there. He closed his eyes and tried to put it all together. 6 months ago, when he got that first call from Edward Fisher, he thought a colleague was pranking him. The famous physicist's Brooklyn accent and staccato cadence were easy enough to imitate. Reese humored the caller, working in a few wisecracks about Fisher's well-known eccentricity, which was said to border on outright insanity. When he realized it really was the great scientist on the phone, he felt simultaneously thrilled and mortified. Dr. Fisher, I'm so sorry. I really thought someone was pulling my leg. Not to worry, it was a reasonable hypothesis. Also, I'm well aware people think I'm half crazy. They're right. It's fortunate for me the other half of my mind functions pretty well. Fisher informed Reese that his current research, when completed, would be impactful, as he put it. He wanted to know if he could call on Reese when the time came to help make it all more comprehensible to the general public. Yes, of course, Reese told him. That's what I do, and I'd be honored. But I have to ask, when did you become concerned with what the public understands? The popular press loved to compare Fisher to Albert Einstein. In temperament, however, Fisher was more like the solitary and obsessive young Isaac Newton. He made Reese, who also tended to keep people at a distance, look positively gregarious. Fisher replied,
I'm concerned with the public's understanding because their confidence in the accuracy of this work affects its larger purpose. Beyond that, I can't say anything right now. Reese wondered if perhaps all this was about some breakthrough in climate change modeling. The credibility of science in the course of public policy did intersect there. But before he could say anything, Fisher spoke again. "Gavin, I understand you're not a religious man."
No, not in the traditional sense.
You were raised Mormon, though.
Where the hell did that come from? Reese knew the information was out there on the internet, but it was hard to picture the 21st century's most famous genius seated at his desk Googling his name.
"Yes, I was a Mormon," Reese said. "How did you lose your faith?"
And it gets even weirder.
"Okay, well, as you yourself are fond of saying, the theory didn't fit the evidence. Israelites in the Americas, the Reformed Egyptian, and the Anthon transcript, it just didn't stand up to scientific scrutiny."
"And did it stop there?"
Reese wasn't sure exactly what Fisher meant, but the conversation was making him increasingly uncomfortable.
"Can I ask what all this has to do with the work you want me to help you popularize?"
"Thank you for your time, Dr. Reese." Fisher disconnected then, without even giving him a chance to say goodbye. Was he offended by something Reese had just said? The whole call had been exceedingly strange. He remembered it had left him wondering for days whether there was something he missed. He opened his eyes at the sound of approaching footsteps in the ER. Officer Honeycutt was returning. Something in his demeanor had shifted. It was subtle, but Reese picked up on it right away. Honeycutt reached Reese's bedside and stood looking down at him, eyes probing.
"Sir, are you currently under the care of any physician or institution we should notify?"
Tactfully put, but the meaning was clear enough. Reese sat up in the hospital bed.
"I know how crazy this sounds, but one of those poor people backed by Pier 35 really is Edward Fisher. The Edward Fisher. Was anybody still alive there?"
Honeycutt paused a moment.
"I just spoke with my supervisor, sir. The units that responded to your report didn't find anything at that location."
"What do you mean, anything? No bodies?
No bodies, no blood, no bullet holes or shell casings, on the chance that you may have misremembered or been confused about which part of the wharf you jumped from. Officers checked the nearby piers, nothing there either."
The rainstorm. It had poured down buckets as Reese swam for the marina. The rain must have washed away any blood. As for bodies and shell casings, well, obviously the gunman didn't want to leave any evidence behind, and apparently he did not.
"So what now?" Reese asked.
"Someone killed three people today and tried to kill me too. Dr. Fisher said I was in danger, and that gunman is still out there."
Officer Honeycutt nodded along as if he agreed completely.
"What we'll do, sir, is we'll file a suspicious incident report. My supervisor will be looking into this thoroughly."
"A suspicious incident report?"
"Yes, sir, that's really about all we can do at this point."
"Would you like us to contact your family?"
"No, thank you." Officer Honeycutt finished by asking if Reese was staying in town, and if so, where. Reese gave him the name of the hotel Fisher had instructed him to use. He was too tired and mixed up to attempt to fly back to New York right now anyway. Honeycutt produced a business card and handed it to Reese.
"You can reach me at this number if you have any questions."
Reese read the card and looked up again.
"I'm not crazy, Officer Honeycutt."
"I didn't say you were, sir."
"I know how this sounds. If I were you, I don't guess I'd buy it either. But just, please, just take this seriously, because something very strange and terrible has happened here, and someone needs to get to the bottom of it."
Honeycutt nodded with a solemn expression. "We'll do everything we can, sir."
And that was it.
Officer Honeycutt left. Reese looked around at the controlled chaos of the ER. Nearby, hospital staff cut the bloody clothes off the victim of a car accident and prepped her for emergency surgery. It brought back an unwelcome memory from Reese's teens, images of his late sister. He felt a pang of sadness mixed with resentment and turned away. The room was buzzing with life and death crises, and as was the case with many big city ERs, the resources here appeared to be strained to their limits.
If someone walked in off the street claiming to suffer from a severe allergy to leprechauns, not a lot of staff time and energy would be assigned to him. The San Francisco Police Department was in exactly the same boat. Reese didn't think they were really going to investigate the shooting of a man who had already died the day before. The two Japanese tourists, the only other eyewitnesses, had to be dead now, too. If they were foreign nationals here on vacation, it could be days or maybe even weeks before the SFPD received any formal inquiries regarding their disappearances. Would someone then connect two missing tourists back to Reese's suspicious incident report? He didn't know, but it didn't seem very promising. "You're in serious danger," Fisher had told him. 3,000 miles away from home, in a city where he knew virtually no one except a colleague or two he might see at a scientific conference, he felt completely alone. Ordinarily, that was a condition Reese immensely enjoyed, even cultivated. Today, he would happily make an exception. He lay back down in the bed and tried to think productively. Somebody wanted him dead. It might help to know more precisely why. He needed to plan his next move, but it was no use theorizing without any real data to work with. Somehow, on his own, he would just have to generate it. How he'd do that, he didn't have a clue. An orderly appeared then, carrying Reese's wet clothes in a clear plastic sack. And something else. Fisher's waterlogged leather pouch. Chapter 3. Terry Sabell didn't have to wait long to move the bodies. Night fell early in Northern California this time of year, even earlier than usual with the day's overcast sky. Not that Sabell minded waiting. He didn't mind anything, really. It was part of his special talent. "You gotta find your special talent, and when you do, that's what you do and nothing else." That's what Sabell's old man always said. He piloted the rented boat on a heading due west. The Point Bonita Lighthouse beacon drifted back lazily on the starboard side as a chill wind tousled his light blonde hair. Sabell thought about his own special talent. It had taken him 33 years and 4 tours of duty to find and fully engage it, but he had. Just a matter of applying his unique assets where they produced the most results. He learned that you got some leverage when you could do things other people can't. Turns out you got even more when you could do things other people won't. The boat's engines thrummed steadily as the Golden Gate Bridge and the lights of San Francisco receded behind him. The smell of diesel smoke mixed in with the living scent of the sea brought back pleasant memories. Fishing in the Gulf of Mexico with his father. Sabell's old man was a shrimper with a small 2-man operation out of Carrabelle, a pissant town in the Florida panhandle. When Sabell was old enough, he started helping out with the family business. By the time he was 17, he'd learned all there was to know about the ship itself and the fishing end of the whole deal. He replaced the second crew member permanently. Sabell was out at sea with his old man on the day he died. They got caught in a furious rain squall. His father was out on deck hauling the nets when he lost his footing and fell overboard. Sabell grabbed a life preserver and ran to the rail. His father looked up and spotted him there. "Terry, throw it!" That's when it happened. Sabell's father was a violent drunk, and though he hit his son pretty regularly after getting sauced, the old man saved the real beatings for Sabell's mother. He wasn't mad at his father for any of that stuff, at least he didn't think so. He wasn't sure what anger felt like, but he knew what it looked like, and he'd never behaved that way. But Sabell's father had got to be a real problem for their family and its little shrimping business. His drinking reached the point where he missed good fishing days. The beatings were getting worse, too. Sabell's mother feared for her life, and with good reason. And Sabell didn't understand the business end of shrimping at all. That was entirely her thing. For that reason, he needed her to stay well and functioning. What they both didn't require any longer was Sabell's alcoholic dad. As his father sputtered and thrashed in the rough seas, Sabell stopped there at the rail and set the life preserver down on the deck. "What are you doing?" his dad shouted up. "Throw me the damn thing!" The rain hammered down thick and heavy, a gray curtain cutting them off from the eyes of the world. Sabelle could barely even see his dad out there in the water, but it looked like he'd managed to catch hold of a section of the net. Yes, he was pulling himself in toward the boat now. Sabelle ran aft, found what he needed, and returned to the rail. By then, his father had made his way to the side of the boat. He was using the shrimp net like a rope ladder, already halfway back up. Sabelle extended the gaffing hook down to his father. His father stretched his hand out for the pole. It was just out of reach. "Lower, Terry! Hold it lower! I can't..." Sabelle lunged down and gaffed the side of his father's neck. Then he pulled back hard with both arms, leveling the pole off the gunwale. His father's full body weight now held him dangling on the hook, which ran behind his trachea and exited his neck under the right ear. Sabelle's father gurgled horribly and grabbed for the pole. He tried to free himself, but it was no use. The gaffing hook did exactly what it was designed to do: keep a flopping catch from working itself loose. When his father finally stopped struggling, Sabelle lowered him back into the water until he floated there on the surface. With the weight off the hook, the gaff slid out easily like it should. That's why you don't ever want to use a barbed gaff. It was something the old man had taught him. As the rains continued to drench him, Sabelle silently thanked his father for being a good instructor and always providing the right tools. He'd reached his destination and cut the engine. This was far enough off the coast for the corpses to sink deep and rot in peace and privacy. He dropped the bodies into the dark waters one by one in no special order. Whatever rank they'd reached in life, they were all on equal footing now. The fish and crabs certainly weren't going to taste any difference. Sabelle restarted the engine and steered the boat back toward the mouth of the bay. As the lights of the city grew brighter, he considered his next objective. The ambulance had taken Gavin Reese to San Francisco General. The hospital itself would not do as a working location, too many witnesses. Security cameras to boot, you could go in disguise, but that sort of Mission Impossible shit worked better in movies. Reese's background information indicated no close contacts in the Bay Area, so the man was likely to end up in a hotel somewhere. That would do just fine. The boat's engine thrummed on. The smell of the ocean and the diesel smoke once again returned Sabelle's mind to those teenage days, back on the shrimp boat with his father. Fond memories, all. Chapter 4. While the hotel desk clerk processed his credit card, Reese watched CNN on the lobby's TV monitor. No sound, but the chyron beneath the picture displayed the headline, "Breaking News." The scroll beneath that summed up the story. DNA analysis of body parts confirmed it, and federal investigators had made the official announcement. Edward Fisher died in yesterday's blast at Fermilab. Yesterday, at Fermilab, federal investigators. Reese didn't want to follow the line of thinking this news story suggested, but he couldn't stop himself. Whatever was going on here, it reached into the U.S. government. Those DNA tests had obviously been faked. What the hell have I gotten myself into here? A decidedly upper-class clientele passed through the lobby, paying no attention to the TV monitor. The Mark Hopkins on Nob Hill provided by no means the most affordable hotel rooms in the city, but Fisher had absolutely insisted Reese should go there and nowhere else. Reese finished checking in, grateful that he still had his wallet. The cell phone was a goner, though, and he'd abandoned his overnight bag out by the pier. If the killer didn't take it, someone else certainly would have by now. San Francisco General Hospital had dipped into its clothes bank. Items left behind and laundered along with the hospital's linens to provide Reese with shirt, pants, jacket, and a pair of very new-looking Nike running shoes that actually fit reasonably well. He politely passed on the second-hand underwear and socks. Once Reese finished checking in, he headed straight up to his suite. The first thing he did there, after he deadbolted the door and attached the security chain, did those little brass links really stop a determined intruder? Was to take a long, hot bath. He did his best thinking in the tub. A personal quirk that left him feeling let down whenever business travel landed him in a hotel room with only a shower. As condensation fogged the bathroom's gilded mirrors, Reese soaked the remaining chill out of his bones and debated with himself on whether he ought to call someone back in New York and explain what was going on out here. But who? And exactly what would he tell them? That Edward Fisher wasn't really dead, except now he was? That a dark conspiracy was underway at the level of the U.S. government by persons unknown for reasons unknowable? Yeah, he said to the bathroom ceiling. That would go over well. His assistant was aware of the impromptu trip to San Francisco and would hold down the fort as usual. Per Edward Fisher's instructions, Reese had made up a vague story about a relative's medical emergency. He'd given no timetable for return. As luck would have it, there were no interviews or TV appearances scheduled for the next several days. Reese had a deadline for a Scientific American article coming up at the end of the week, but he'd finished the first two drafts. It only needed a polish. He could get to it later. For the moment, Reese could do what he wanted, and he wanted to find some goddamn answers. If he went public now with what he'd seen and nothing to back it up, it would only damage his reputation. Maybe he'd be safe confiding it all to a close friend, but for the small matter of his not really having any. Warm acquaintances, both professional and personal, sure. Closer than that, and the risk-reward ratio just didn't work, not for him. People ultimately disappoint. He'd learned that long ago. So no phone calls, no statements to the press. For better or for worse, you're in this thing alone. The bathwater had gone tepid. Reese climbed out of the tub, towel dry, and wrapped himself up in one of the hotel's luxurious terry cloth robes. Thinking next, as he always did, that there was no good reason to wear anything but one of these things, ever. He carried a dry white towel with him out of the bathroom and spread it out across the hotel room's mahogany writing desk. Then he removed Fisher's wet leather pouch from the clear plastic bag in which the hospital had returned it to him. The police and hospital staff had just assumed the pouch belonged to Reese. At first, he thought the bag's contents might connect it to Fisher and support his story. Then he realized he couldn't establish a timeline to prove he hadn't just possessed the pouch since before Fisher was supposedly blown up. So on the chance that something in there might throw some light on all this, he decided not to inform the police of their mistake. He kept the pouch and its contents for himself. Reese carefully removed those contents again, one item at a time, and laid them out on the towel. All right, let's take another look at all this stuff. Green spiral notebook, thoroughly waterlogged. He set that aside. Bus schedule from Greyhound. That didn't look very promising. Next, he gently pulled out several soggy, loose sheets of paper, covered in mathematical expressions, and the occasional brief note. Most of them were badly smeared. One loose sheet stood apart, inasmuch as it had not been authored by Fisher, a printout of a published paper on DNA synthesis. Something about the author byline drew Reese's attention. Upon closer inspection, he didn't recognize any of the scientists listed there. He moved on. Toothbrush, cheap reading glasses, and, hey, where'd you come from? Something there at the bottom of the pouch he hadn't noticed back in the ER. A black, plastic, flash drive. Unsurprisingly, the drive was as wet as the rest of the pouch's contents. It might be waterproof, many were these days, but if not, borrowing a laptop and plugging the flash drive in with any moisture present would fry it. He set the drive on the towel to dry out thoroughly. Then he returned to the green notebook. Fisher had written number 127 on the cover. Perhaps this was part of a series. Reese opened it. As with the loose sheets, the ink here had smeared, though not quite as badly. Large portions were perfectly legible. The entries were dated. Turning to the very last page showed the notes there had been made about 5 years ago. Why had Fisher been carrying around this particular old notebook? The notebook's contents looked familiar to Reese, as they would to any astrophysicist with the requisite mathematical training. The first section contained explorations of the Einstein field equations for general relativity. These ideas alternated back and forth with novel formulations of the Dirac and Yang-Mills equations, which suggested thinking more along quantum mechanical lines. What are you up to here, Dr. Fisher? Further along, Rees found formula representing higher dimensional structures called D-brains. Some form of string theory there. An angry hand had viciously crossed out several pages of those expressions, rewritten them somewhat differently, and crossed them all out again. Well, that didn't quite work for you, did it? The ideas in the notebook seemed at war with each other. And no surprise there, really. Relativity was, in a sense, at war with quantum mechanics. If not at war, then at least hostile estrangement. Relativity described gravity and the universe on a vast cosmic scale. Quantum mechanics operated mainly at the subatomic level and described the other three fundamental forces. Each theory required the other for completeness, but no one had succeeded in marrying them together into a workable theory of quantum gravity. Rees turned another page and stared at it for a full minute in wonder. What in the world? Something bizarre and elegant, to be sure. Still mathematical expressions of some kind here, but the symbols and diagrams were entirely unknown to him. Fisher had written out something like a key at the bottom of the page, and on the next few pages, along with a note, not workable, nothing for it, but the Newtonian approach. The Newtonian approach? Calculus? This thing is already filled with calculus. Rees flipped forward through the notebook. The strange notations decorated the pages like some kind of fantastic alien artwork. He could sense something here of enormous power and beauty, and the effects of it were almost hypnotic. He felt his mind relaxing open. As he flipped back to Fisher's key, it came to him. Nothing for it but Newton's approach. Jesus! He's invented a whole new mathematical discipline. When Newton developed his laws of motion and optics, the mathematics available to him at the time were inadequate to the task, so he simply invented the calculus. Apparently, Fisher had done the same sort of thing here. Rees studied Fisher's key, applying it to the complex expressions that filled the rest of the notebook. He flipped back and forth, slowly but steadily teasing out the ideas expressed in this glorious new language that he was reading. And as he did, Fisher's math completely transported him. He no longer sat in a hotel room in San Francisco. He was soaring above a landscape of pure idea. This was the world Rees had longed to live in since his teens, a world beyond human cares and woes. An eternal place, shining and true, that revealed itself only to the pure of mind. This was the very reason he had turned to science as his passion, to live and work here among the forces that shaped the universe and ignited the stars. Sabelle parked the van at the bottom of Knob Hill and walked up Mason Street toward the Mark Hopkins. The wet black asphalt shone like volcanic glass, reflecting the rubies and diamonds of car taillights and headlights as they passed. Finding this target had been a routine matter. Gavin Rees left a local address with San Francisco General as part of their standard patient processing protocol. The government ID Sabelle had flashed at hospital staff gained him easy access to their records. Through his shoes, Sabelle felt the faint vibration of the twisted steel cable whirring beneath the street. The power that drove the city's cable cars flowed underground, out of sight. Where all real power dwelled, a tingle arose deep inside him. A city at night, even cold and damp like this, always excited Sabelle. Darkness invited those who didn't fear it. And fear was another emotion that Sabelle only knew from witnessing it. But he had done that many, many times. Chapter 5. A sound intruded into Rees's awareness. Rhythmic. Thumping. Someone knocking on the hotel room door. Rees realized that the knocking had actually repeated several times already. So deeply had Fisher's notebook engrossed him that his mind hadn't fully processed the interruption. Even now he resisted breaking off from the mathematical high-wire act before him. especially since he had just begun to see that this was more than pure theory. It had a purpose.
The knocking persisted. Reese sighed and rose from the desk. He checked that he'd properly closed and tied his bathrobe and walked over to the door. Probably hotel staff bringing up the socks and underwear he requested. He'd felt like some spoiled aristocrat asking the concierge's assistance with something like that. But then high-end hotels were always happy to pamper their guests, particularly quasi-famous guests like Reese. And it certainly couldn't be the oddest request the concierge had ever fielded. He started to undo the security chain, then flashed back on the events of the day and paused to take a look through the peephole. It was not hotel staff. Hotel staff would not be holding up a piece of government ID with a badge on it. A thrill of optimism shot through him. The authorities wouldn't bother with a personal nighttime visit unless they'd found something of real consequence. Perhaps another witness to the shooting had come forward. He unslotted the chain, turned the bolt, and opened the door. "Kevin Reese?" the woman standing there asked.
"Yes. Are you with the police department?"
"No, sir. I'm with the Defense Criminal Investigative Service. We're a federal agency. May I come in?"
Reese felt awkward inviting an attractive woman into his hotel room while dressed in nothing but a bathrobe. He considered asking her to wait. That seemed like a foolish bit of old-fashioned modesty, though, particularly with a law officer. So he stepped aside and let her in, then closed the door after her. They faced each other there in the suite's foyer. She stood about Reese's height, 5'11", a little tall for a woman, late 20s, he would guess.
"I'm Special Agent Carrie Morgan," she said. "I understand you witnessed a shooting this afternoon on Fisherman's Wharf, Mr. Reese?"
"Yes, I did. It was Dr. Reese, technically, but he never made that correction and always flinched a little inside when another academic did." Agent Morgan pulled out a notebook and pen. She had a hard look about her. Short, cropped, dark brown hair, and an athletic build, at least from what Reese could see. Somehow it all added to her visual appeal.
"I apologize in advance for asking a lot of the same questions you probably already answered for the San Francisco Police Department, but DCIS has to conduct its investigation independently."
Reese nodded. "Sure, that's not a problem. But I'd like to know, do you understand who was shot out there today, along with those two tourists? Who it is that I saw?"
"Yes, sir."
"Edward Fisher."
"Yes."
Reese paused, then said very clearly, "Dr. Edward Fisher, the man who was blown up at Fermilab yesterday?"
"Yes, sir, I understand."
She kept her expression blank, but the words were enough for him. Reese let out a long, slow breath and felt some of his tension going out with it. Finally, someone here believed him. What followed immediately on the heels of that was a question. Why should she? He could think of only one reason. He invited Agent Morgan into the dining area. He offered her some bottled water. She declined. Reese noted her clothes as they stepped over to the table, khaki pants and a dark winter coat that didn't look departmental. When they were both seated, Reese said, "Agent Morgan, before we begin, you knew that Edward Fisher wasn't killed in that explosion at Fermilab? You must have, or you wouldn't be here talking to me." Morgan took a moment, and Reese got the impression she was weighing how much she needed or wanted to reveal to him.
"Not immediately," she said, "but Fisher called me last night."
"He called you too? So you knew him?"
"He was involved in a project for the DOD, and we met once about a year ago. Last night he provided information that verified his identity. He asked me to meet him here in San Francisco today, out by Pier 35.
Reese just stared, utterly confused now.
"Wait, you were supposed to be there today?"
"I was late. I booked a commercial flight from D.C. that was delayed. When I got to Pier 35, SFPD was already there, responding to a report of a shooting. Your report." Something Fisher said came rushing back to Reese. "You're the muscle."
"What?"
"Fisher mentioned you."
"Not specifically, but he was talking about you. It had to be. The muscle."
"I've been called worse, I guess." 100 questions swirled in Reese's head like autumn leaves in a whirlwind. He mentally snatched one as it flashed by.
"You took a commercial flight?" The Department of Defense doesn't have transport jets at its disposal? Morgan paused again. The Department of Defense didn't know that Fisher was still alive, because I didn't tell them.
The whirlwind had just turned into a tornado. A knock came at the door. Rhys headed over to it. That would be the hotel staff. I asked them to pick something up for me. When Rhys opened the door, a man in a gray business suit stood there in the hallway. He held up an SFPD detective ID and badge for Rhys. Something about him felt vaguely familiar. Light blonde hair, almost white. Pale blue eyes. Dr. Rhys? He flipped the ID while it closed, put it away.
Yes, are...
With no change of expression, the blonde man shot an arm out and grabbed a fistful of the front of Rhys's robe. He shoved Rhys backwards into the room. Hey! Rhys backpedaled, flailing his arms. The man's head snapped to the left. He reached into his jacket with his free hand. Don't! Agent Morgan had a gun out and aimed in their direction. The blonde man went still, a tense stillness. A predator who sees it's been spotted by its prey and freezes. Suddenly he jerked Rhys out toward him and spun him around, while backing them both out through the door. Out in the hallway, he threw an arm lock around Rhys's neck and dragged him backwards down the hall. Rhys felt something hard and cold pressed painfully against his right ear. He stumbled on the hem of his bathrobe. Stay on your feet, the blonde man hissed. At that moment, Agent Morgan's head and one shoulder appeared out of Rhys's hotel room door. It sounded like a bomb exploded in Rhys's ear. Morgan disappeared just as a window shattered at the other end of the hallway. His hands flew up in a defensive reflex to the loud noise. He found them wrapped around the other man's hand and what had to be a gun. He didn't have any advantage in physical strength or fighting skills since he didn't possess either in meaningful amounts. But he knew force vectors and simple machines. He pulled down with both arms, then lifted his feet off the floor as if he were doing a chin-up off the other man's forearm. Let gravity do the work for him. Rhys's attacker was strong, but not strong enough to hold up 175 pounds with one bicep. The man's arm gave out, too late, though, to stop Rhys from tugging them both off balance, exactly as he'd hoped. Together they crashed into the wall on one side of the hallway. Rhys slid to the carpeted floor and flopped face down. Something pointy jabbed him in the ribs. He'd fallen right on top of the gun. It must have been knocked loose. The blonde man seemed to know where the gun was, too. He flattened out on top of Rhys and started reaching under him. Rhys tried to get his hands to the gun first, without lifting himself and giving the other man access to it. The two of them grappled like football players fighting for a fumble down on the grass. Stop! Show me your hands! Rhys looked up in the direction of Special Agent Morgan's voice. She crab-walked toward them down the hallway, her gun held out in front of her. Show me your hands, now! The blonde man sat up on his knees and raised both hands. Where's the gun? Morgan asked. Rhys still hadn't moved. It's under me. The blonde man began slowly standing up. Morgan stepped in closer, her gun still trained at Rhys's attacker. Get back on your knees and lace your hands behind your head.
Yeah, all right, the man replied calmly as he continued to stand.
I said on your knees. The blonde man sprung like a jack-in-the-box. One moment he stood there in the hallway, the next moment the sound of crashing glass made Rhys flinch and close his eyes. In his mind, though, he could still see the blonde man's black socks and dress shoes as they disappeared out of the hotel's 16th-story window.
And those are the first five chapters of Lee Bervin's sci-fi novel with secular themes called The Kaffir Project. I certainly hope you enjoyed it and you'll consider taking the journey further. The links are in the description box of this broadcast, or just go to audible.com and type in The Kaffir Project, K-A-F-I-R. Next Tuesday is kind of a personal story I've been sharing all around the country over these past months. It's a speech called The Mystery Letter, and I can't give you a whole lot more just yet. You got to just tune in next Tuesday as we kind of take a journey through a certain chapter or chapters of my life and tie it in to, I think, some larger themes relating to religion and secularism and how we approach each other as human beings. I think it's powerful stuff. I think you're really going to enjoy it. It's called The Mystery Letter. And then, of course, after that, we prepare for broadcast 300, which is a whole other thing. Going to be amazing. Have a wonderful week. I will see you next time on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.